Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Autism seems to have more power to fascinate and confound than any other mental disability. It even inspired the libretto for this Philip Glass opera, Einstein on the Beach, which was written by a young autistic poet named Christopher Knowles. Autism has also been an ongoing interest of our next guest, the physician and author Dr. Oliver Sacks. In books like Awakenings and The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, he has introduced us to not only people with autism, but a range of neurological conditions. His latest book, just out in paperback, is called Musicophilia, Tales of Music and the Brain, and it brings Dr. Oliver Sacks to our studio today. So you heard Elaine Hall's story in The Miracle Project. What's your reaction?
It was wonderful and fascinating how, as she said, music can normalize and create community among these most isolated people. I've seen this myself to some extent. In fact, many years ago when I worked at a hospital with many autistic patients, I brought my own piano to the hospital because this could be the focus for them. I've seen this power of music in so many groups. Most recently, I was at a therapeutic farm for deeply schizophrenic people, and there was a campfire meeting where some people were singing and some were playing the guitar, and anyone coming in would never have known that these were deeply schizophrenic people. They were just people making music, bonding together. I also know of music camps and this sort of thing for people with Tourette syndrome, people with Williams syndrome, people with Down syndrome. So this power of music is very great.
And it may be great. How lasting is it? I mean, when the kids come off the stage or when the deeply schizophrenic people, the campfire is out and the guitars are put away, is there a lingering impact?
Well, if some relationships have been established, then there will be.
Okay, here's a comment on the Soundcheck page of our website from that girl in New York who writes, I have a nephew who had autism but has since been mainstreamed via much therapy. From what we were told, music and its associated metering is much like the counting associated with autistic people. Interesting, that excerpt we heard from Philip Glass's Einstein on the Beach, the relentless counting. It serves to keep the autistic in the bubble that keeps them from interacting fully with the non-autistic. Does that kind of jive with what you've seen in your own work?
I'm not quite sure what was said. Music, as she says,
music
like
music
counting.
And its associated metering is much like the counting associated with autistic people. Yes. Keeps the autistic in the bubble that keeps them away from interacting fully with the non-autistic. She goes on to write, given that so many autistics prefer to stay in a comfort zone of music or counting, including these savants, this is, in the opinion of many, counterproductive to bringing them out. Yes, these children are often entertaining to us, but at what cost? Are they merely imitating what they hear?
I wondered this with an autistic boy called Stephen Wilshire, who was a visual savant, but also he turned out to be a musical savant as well, and he loved Tom Jones and Stevie Wonder, and in a way did a sort of impersonation of them. I was never clear whether this enabled him to access emotions. I remember I wrote in my notebook, autism disappears when he did this, or whether it was a sort of imitation. But whatever it was, it worked.
When you mention, you've written about Stephen Wilshire a couple of times. This is the English artist who does these incredible detailed building landscape drawings and such.
And after a glance of 2 or 3 seconds, he can have, you know, the Empire State Building, and he'll do it correctly. He can't count, but he'll put in the 102 floors or whatever it has.
It sort of goes to the listener's comment. I mean, what he's doing is mimicry, isn't it? It's incredibly detailed and very finely detailed mimicry, but that is what he's doing.
Mimicry, reproduction. Sometimes there may be a little bit of improvisation.
Mm. Okay, so once I guess that's where you begin to, and one of the things you talk about in the relevant chapters of Musicophilia about things like autism is the left brain and the right brain growing differently in utero, and the one hemisphere then dominating the other. Is music a way of kind of reversing that pattern of one hemisphere dominating the other when that's called for?
I don't know whether one could put it that way or not. I think certainly, you know, music brings out sort of the emotions and the bonding. I don't know that it helps, say, with the difficulty of abstract thought and language, which often go with being a savant.
And is that because there is no one musical part of the brain?
No, indeed. There are dozens of different parts of the brain are recruited for music, whether one's listening to it, imagining it, composing it, hallucinating it.
All of which happens. You've written about musical hallucinations as well. What about people, maybe Stephen Wiltshire, whom you mentioned, is an example of this, but people who can hear music and perhaps even can appreciate the distinction between loud and soft, dramatic or static, but who don't get it? You know what I mean? Don't get the emotional impact.
There are some people who will recognize music precisely but don't have an emotional impact. This can sometimes happen after a stroke or a concussion, and there are systems of the brain, there are separate systems in the brain for perceiving the structure of music and its emotional effect. But there are also some people with so-called congenital amusia who do not perceive music. They can't tell whether one tone is higher than another. They can't detect a discord. They don't hear semitones. They don't have the building blocks of music. And for them, music doesn't sound like music.
Has any work been done with autistic kids to see whether amusia is something that afflicts some of them? I mean, it seems like all of Elaine's kids that we were talking about before immediately responded to music. Yeah. But is that the exception or the rule?
I was a little surprised at that, but what many autistic kids do have is a difficulty with the phonemes of language. And sometimes autistic kids who are unable to speak or recognize speech can sing and recognize song, and if therefore the language is embedded in the song,
And can they access the emotional content
yes,
of music?
Yes, indeed.
Mm. Well, that would certainly in part explain the success that Elaine with the Miracle Project has had. My guest is Dr. Oliver Sacks. This is Soundcheck.
Today on the Soundcheck blog,
maybe Western science is just now catching up to something the world's oldest cultures have instinctively known, that music can heal a troubled or damaged mind.
For the rest of the story, go to the Soundcheck blog at WNYC.org.
Dr. Oliver Sacks is with me in our Soundcheck studio. What about we talk a lot about music and we almost exclusively talk about Western music. There are these so-called trance music traditions, a somewhat dismissive term that we in the West often use for things like Moroccan Gnawa music or many other ancient traditions where the music is often used for exorcising evil spirits, which a modern Western psychologist might come in and say, that's schizophrenia, you know, that's some kind of mental pathology. Have these cultures somehow instinctively cottoned on to the impact that music can have on the brain?
Well, there's certainly no culture that we know of which doesn't have music, and one has flutes and musical instruments going back 40,000 years. Among the primal uses of music, I think, have been religious and magical and therapeutic uses, as well as sort of social and martial and whatever. The Greeks consider that there were various musical modes which could have profound effects on different mental states. I think some of these modes were supposed to induce trance. Incidentally, I've nothing against trance. I think it can be a good state, and most of us sort of are almost trapped in our own consciousness and a normal way of looking things, and we may need to be entranced. In a looser sense, I think music has a unique power to entrance all of us.
Well, it's interesting to hear you enumerate the various ways in which music has been used over the course of human history, you know, spiritual, martial, therapeutic, or whatever, because one of the things that you write about in Musicophilia is the fact that it doesn't seem to have any real kind of survival, there doesn't seem to be any compelling biological need for music, at least not for the human species.
Well, this has been argued about. If there's no compelling biological need, why do we have it? Darwin, for example, thought there was some compelling biological need. He thought that music had perhaps developed for courtship and for establishing communal relations, maybe marking out territory, and that language had come later. But some aspects of music, in particular beat or rhythm, are definitely hardwired in the nervous system and must have evolved at a very early stage, and at least among mammals, seem unique to human beings. Kids of two or three will spontaneously keep time to music they hear or imagine. They'll dance. A chimpanzee won't dance. A chimpanzee can't keep time.
And this is all right, and interesting. Now, you mentioned Charles Darwin. There is the story of Darwin as he aged, claiming that music no longer moved him the way it did when he was a younger man. I mean, can listening to music keep the mind limber the same way that exercising keeps the muscles kind of pliable and limber as you age?
I like to think so. Certainly a major part of my own life. Darwin's family disagreed with what he said. They thought he was portraying himself as somehow burnt out. Though fascinatingly, as a young man, Darwin describes how he would go to choirs in Cambridge, and the music would send shivers down his spine. He uses this phrase, even though he couldn't recognize it, and he couldn't. And he wondered how one could be so in a way deaf to music, and yet so overwhelmed by it.
Well, we're talking today about the way in which music can impact the brain, and we were talking before about autistic kids. You've written a lot about Parkinson's patients. In fact, I guess that was how you got started down this road to begin with back in the 60s.
Yeah.
There is the story of Rosalie B., who responded specifically to the music of Chopin. What can we take from this? Tell us the story, and what's our takeaway from Rosalie B.?
Right. This was a woman who had the sleeping sickness, the encephalitis lethargica, and for hours a day she would be absolutely motionless, often with a finger on one spectacle lens. But she was very musical. She actually loved Chopin and Schubert. She played the piano, and as soon as if one led her to a piano and sat her down and got her going, then she would be transformed. And while she played beautifully, and she was not Parkinsonian. And very interestingly, even if you just said to her, what should we say, Opus 49, the Chopin F minor fantasy would start to play in her mind, and even that would release her. And here we hear it at the moment.
Chopin Fantasy in F Minor, Opus 49, figures prominently in the story of Dr. Oliver Sacks' patient, Rosalie B. Are there certain types of music that are more suitable for this kind of use?
Rosalie happened to like Chopin and Schubert. I think for people who have Parkinson's, the crucial thing is the music have a strong rhythm, it have a strong beat. It doesn't have to be familiar, but it has to have a rhythmic structure and a time structure, because basically people with Parkinson's lose their sense of rhythm and time and of internal counting. And for them, even if things don't come to a stop, they tend to be too fast or too slow. Music gives temporal order. Music holds them in time, and it articulates them in time, and it's crucial.
Now, as the field of music therapy has grown in importance and in acceptance, really, in the last couple of decades, do music therapists or anybody else involved in this field have a way of kind of, I don't want to use the term scientifically, but let's say, you know, categorizing music according to its rhythmic and its tonal and its harmonic aspects into types of music that will work and types of music that may upset the patient?
This is certainly one of the things which goes on with music therapists, although at the moment I would say it's more at a sort of fairly general categorical. I mean, one knows that music for people with a dementia has to be familiar music, which they've known from the past, and music which is correlated with memory and emotion. It's different. That is not needed for the people with Parkinson's, but they need rhythm.
Okay, so different uses will require different types of music.
Yeah.
Okay. What about your own experience? I mean, I mentioned it was working with people with Parkinson's that got you started on this, but you write about having a personal experience of amusia in the Bronx.
Oh, indeed, and associated with Chopin. No, I was, and also with the station, although I think at that time it was 104.3. No, I was driving back in the Bronx, and I was listening to a Chopin ballade, in fact, ballade number 4, and it became rather strange and sort of tinny and toneless, and after a minute or so, it sounded as if it was being beaten out on steel drums or steel bars. And then it started to come back after about 10 minutes towards the end. And I phoned up the station and I said, was that some sort of joke or experiment? I described things. And they said, no, you better check your car radio. So I was sort of puzzled, but I then had the experience a couple of weeks later when I myself was at my piano and
Playing Chopin, the same piece?
Playing Chopin. And this time it coincided with a brilliant zigzag, which was part of a migraine scotoma, part of a visual migraine. And so I had a bit of an auditory migraine as well. I'd had migraine auras in which sounds might be increased or diminished or hollow or seashell-like, but those two occasions have been my only experience of complete amusia. But I'm glad I'd had them, because now I know what it must be like for people.
And if you hear that music again, it doesn't trigger any episodes
I hope not.
Since we were just playing some of it for you there.
I know. it hasn't done so far.
At the opposite end of the spectrum, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, music as therapy, as something that people need, but then there are people for whom music is just like, it just comes pouring out. I mean, Elaine, whom we were talking to earlier from the Miracle Project, Elaine Hall, talked about savants.
Yes.
You write about savants. Is this a blessing or a curse?
A gift can be both. I think it may be lovely for an otherwise rather disabled, autistic, and perhaps retarded person to have a gift. It can give them delight, it can give others delight, but it can also engross them almost to the exclusion of anything else.
Sort of what the listener, the comment I read before was talking about, the music or the counting that autistic...
I somehow wanted to say, you know, I think counting is pathological, but music isn't. Although, interestingly, the philosopher Leibniz said music is counting, but counting unconsciously. But I think obsessive conscious counting certainly restricts one, whereas I think music is generally liberating.
Well, as with everything, there's kind of a spectrum. I mean, there's a spectrum of autism from very high functioning to much lower functioning, and there's kind of a spectrum of musical gifts as well.
You know, it comes to me. There was a description of a calculating prodigy who was probably also autistic. When he was taken to a concert, he could say how many notes were played. When he was taken to a play, how many words were said or how many syllables. He completely missed the meaning and the feeling of both.
Well, what about a musical gift like perfect pitch? That's according to, you know, some of the things you've written, that seems to be much rarer in the general population than it is with people who are visually impaired, for example.
Yeah, in the general population, it's maybe 1 in 5,000 or something. Curiously, in people who are congenitally blind, it's 1 in 2 or 1 in 3. People who are born blind may need every possible sort of auditory and tactile cue. And there's some suggestion that all of us may have absolute pitch in the first year of life. Most of us lose it. But those who are visually impaired, and interestingly, those who are language impaired, like autistic people, or those who have intense musical education, or those who use a tonal language like Thai or Mandarin, they tend to keep it.
Now, is that a chicken and egg kind of thing? Can you say, you know, that it's because one hemisphere of the brain is developing quicker and is suppressing the musical function, the perfect pitch function? Or is it the opposite, that the perfect pitch function is weakened and so something else takes its place?
Yeah. Well, I think in normal development, I think perfect pitch may interfere with the perception of speech and various other things. It becomes counter-adaptive. Some people with, incidentally, the original title of my book, which with some reluctance I gave up, was based on what a little boy with perfect pitch said in the 19th century when he said, "Papa blows his nose in G."
I have to say, Musicophilia is a really nice title, but that is genius. I mean, so you'll just have to use that for the next book.
Right.
Papa blows his nose in G. Well, of course, you know, we could go on and on because there are so many. I mean, there are people who see colors, there's synesthesia, etc. But the book Musicophilia is out now in paperback by Dr. Oliver Sacks, who's also author of the book The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Some of Michael Nyman's operatic setting of that book in the background. Oliver, a real pleasure having you with us on the show today. Thank you very much for joining us on Soundcheck.
I've loved it. Thanks.
Coming up next, Mark Oliver Everett, frontman of the rock band Eels, talks about writing a memoir exploring his complicated relationship with his late father, a quantum physicist. And the election's less than a week away. Help us identify a song that captures the spirit of democracy. You can cast your vote on our website, the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.